we are going to be learning together a midrash that I only discovered recently, and which I think gets to some of the pieces of Tisha B'Av that I had been feeling were missing for me this year. Specifically, when we think about Tisha B'Av, we think about sadness, we think about grief, but we also think about anger. There's a lot of anger that happens with mourning, with grief. You know, the five stages of grief include one of those stages, which is anger. And if you look at Eicha, you do see anger, but primarily what you see in the Book of Lamentations in Eicha is God's anger towards us, our anger at ourselves. And rarely, if at all, do you actually see anger towards God. And specifically, I would say you see it maybe in a few places. For example, when the Book of Eicha says, Haragta lo chamalta, you have killed our people without any mercy, right? There's a sort of implicit anger there, an accusation. But it really is not the dominant theme of the book. The dominant theme of the book is sadness, it's loss, it's God's anger, and it is what we, and is our feelings of our own role, our own guilt in what we've brought upon ourselves. This Midrash from Midrash Zuta, section on Eicha, it's a bit of an obscure text. We've had it quoted by commentators since the 11th century, but it was really only published in the 19th century by Shlomo Buber. And this is a text I really think we'll see really gets into putting God, as the title of this shir is, says, on trial. So without further ado, let's just jump right into the text. I want to make sure we get through all of it. This text begins with a quote from Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, kind of the opposite of the Book of Eicha, right? The Book of Eicha is a book all about grief and tragedy and loss. Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim, is a book about love. And it begins with this verse, Mi tencha ka'achli yonek shedei imi. Would that you were like a brother to me, nursing at the breasts of my mother. Now, this is a strange verse, especially if you don't know what Shir HaShirim is about. But in context, this is a verse about a female lover speaking to her male lover. And what she's saying is, I wish we were like brother and sister so that we could kiss and touch each other and not be judged by others, right? It's basically the sort of, you know, pretending to be siblings so that we can actually be intimate with each other. You can see that from the remainder of the verse, which we're not going to look at right now. But also, as I'm sure many of you know, the book of the Song of Songs is understood by the rabbis metaphorically. So the female lover in this book is us, is Israel, and the male lover is God. And so our Midrash in Eicha begins with this verse about us. Well, depending on how you want to read it, either a lover begging for her lover to be closer to her, to be able to be public about their love, or about us asking to be in that way with God. And one of the things that I want to want us to think about as we're going through this Midrash, we're not really going to come back to this verse, at least not in an explicit way. And so thinking about what is it about this verse from Song of Songs, about lovers who want to be siblings, what is it that prompts all of the Midrashim we're going to be looking at in this passage? So that's the starting verse. And the Midrash goes like this. La'asid lavo, yavo HaKadosh Baruch Hu lefaisal Knesset Yisrael. In the future, God will come to appease the Jewish people, to appease Knesset Yisrael. V'hi omeres lefanav, and she, the Jewish people, Knesset Yisrael, will say before God, Ribono shel olam, v'ma esnachem, Master of the universe, how can I possibly be comforted? How can I possibly accept your appeasement? Shelo asisa li afilu kibasar v'adam, because we now speaking to God, you, God, have not even acted to me the way that basic human beings act. Yosef, shehu basar v'adam, af al pisha gamlu echav ra'os, lo nakam mehem. Joseph, even though his brothers did total evil to him, they sold him into slavery, they ruined his life, it would seem, right? But he did not take vengeance on them. He did not take revenge on them. Ella, kshabau echav etzlo, kavash rachamav aleihem. Rather, when his brothers came to him, and this next phrase, I should tell you, it's very unclear it's clear what the Hebrew means. It's unclear how it means this, right? The word kavash is something like to conquer or to suppress. Doesn't really make sense here. But what's clear is that Yosef showed mercy to his brothers. Shneamar, v'lo yaholos Yosef lihizapek. As it says, Yosef cannot hold himself back. He's trying to continue this mirage of he's this Egyptian leader, but he can't hold himself back. He actually goes and kisses his brothers. He can't hold back from crying. He has this mercy for his brothers. He does not take vengeance on them, even though they have done awful things to him. Avalata, lo kavash derachamecha mimeni. But you, God, you, whatever this phrase means, you didn't do this thing. You didn't show us mercy. V'henachta omanuscha shekasu b'cha Hashem, Hashem, kel rachum v'chanun. But you You didn't show mercy to us. Rather, you gave up on what you're supposed to be, your natural trait, as it's written about you, God, God, a God merciful and graceful, right? In other words, you, God, were not merciful with us. We did not do any worse to you than Yosef's brothers did to him. Yosef, a mere mortal, showed mercy to his brothers and not take vengeance on them. But you, God, you took vengeance on us, right? So the accusation is leveled right away. And in this Midrash, there's no response. We have accused God of failing to be even as good as Yosef, a mere mortal, and God does not respond. I'd point out two things here. One is that in this Midrash, we're going to see another Midrash in a moment, but in this version, it is somewhat clear how this verse from Shir HaShirim, from Song of Songs, gets us started, would that you were like my brother, because essentially what the Midrash is saying is, you should be like my brother and therefore show me mercy and not be some cruel overlord who is destroying us for our failings. That's one piece I want to point out. The other piece to point out here is that this Midrash actually is very reminiscent of a much better known Midrash, the one in which Rachel cries for her children. That's a verse from Jeremiah. She cries for her children. The Midrash understands that to mean that she's the one who causes God to show mercy to us. And the way she does it is by saying, God, I was not envious of my sister. I'm the one who helped Leah trick Yaakov into bringing her into his bedroom, even though I was in love with Yaakov. I was not envious. I was not jealous. You, God, should also not be envious, not be jealous. So we have this sort of theme of God failing to be as good as certain Jewish leaders have been. And that's the accusation we make against God. Okay, that's the first part of the Midrash. But now the Midrash continues, where it says in English, another interpretation. Devar acher. Amra lefanav. So the Jewish people, Knesset Yisrael, says before God, Ribono shel olam, master of the universe, Zechur ani achva v'reyus shahayali imach. I remember the siblinghood, the achva, and the friendship that I had with you. V'yodazani kama nisim ugvuros shasisali. And I know how many miracles and mighty acts you did for me. Afani asisi lach tovos. I also did good things for you. Kidashti eshimcha gadol. Alo samanisim ugvuros. I sanctified your great name for those miracles and mighty deeds. And now we're on to page 2. V'amarti shira al kol nes v'nes. And I recited poetry for each and every miracle. V'kibalti torascha, mashalo kiblu umos ha'olam. And I accepted your Torah, which the nations of the world did not accept. We're on page 2 now. I accepted your Torah, which the nations of the world did not accept. V'tzipisi she'ekanes ani v'ata l'gan Eden v'tismacheni sham. And what did I expect? I expected that you and I, you God and I, the Jewish people, we would go into Gan Eden, to the Garden of Eden, and you would bring me joy there. You would make me rejoice there. Shene'amar, as it stated, this is the next verse in Shir HaShirim, in Song of Songs, after the one that began this whole series of Midrashim. Shene'amar, en hagachacha aviyacha el beis imi telamedeni. I will lead you, I will bring you into my mother's house, the one who taught me. And so this verse is understood now as, well, it's actually an interesting thing, right? That the way the Midrash reading is that I expected that you, God, would bring us into paradise to be joyous together there. But actually the verse is spoken from the perspective of the woman, which is in this case is the Jewish people. I would lead you, God, into Gan Eden and lead you into this garden, right? But that's what I'm expecting. I'm expecting that God and Israel have entered a relationship and it's going to end with a honeymoon, as it were, right? In Gan Eden. Kevan shenichnas leveischa. But as soon as I entered your house into the land of Israel, into Jerusalem, into the temple, you brought upon me enemies and you caused them to laugh at me. You set them upon me. Shenamar, and now we get a verse from Eicha, from Lamentations. Ra'uhat sarim sachaku al mishpateha. Right? That the enemies saw her, meaning Jerusalem, and they laughed and they gloated over her downfall. They laughed at her downfall. B'mas nachem. So this is the worst thing, right? We were together. I was fulfilling your word. I was doing all these great things. I accepted your Torah. I publicized your miracles. And what did you do? You didn't bring me to a honeymoon that lasted forever, but rather as soon as I came into your house, you brought enemies upon me who brought me all the grief, all the tragedy that we read about in Lamentations. How can I possibly be comforted? This is Israel's accusation against God. And unlike the first Midrash, where God did not respond, in this second Midrash, this Devar Acher, this other interpretation, we get God's response. Amar le Akash Baruch Hu, at omeres kach, lo tzarti imach ba'oso tzar. You're accusing me of bringing all these terrible things upon you. But didn't I suffer with you? Wasn't I engaged in that same suffering? I also suffered. It's not only you, Israel, God says, who are suffering. Now, this is a strange response, right? It's not a defense that says, no, I actually didn't do this. Or it's not a response that says, no, you deserve this. Rather, it is God saying, yeah, I'm also suffering. It's almost as if it's beyond God's control to all the suffering that God has brought upon the Jewish people. So this is a different moment from the first one where we accuse God of not even being as good as Yosef. God doesn't respond. Here we accuse God of having led us on, of having misled us. And God says, you know what? I'm also in that suffering with you. Mashal, lamad vardomeh, right? This thing that we just said, there's a parable that will help us understand it. What is it like? Lamelech basar v'dam, shebao alav oivim, v'yitzitu esh b'veso. It is like a flesh and blood king upon whom enemies came and they lit the palace on fire. V'haya yoshev v'domeh. What does this king do? He doesn't run. He doesn't fight back. He sits quietly in his palace as it is on fire, as the flames are all around him. Amar, ma'aseh. The sovereign says, what should I do? Amod v'arutzim b'beisi. Should I stand up and run from my house? Ein b'choch b'derech. I don't have the strength to run. Yashav v'haya magi ha'or etzlo. The king sits down in his palace, and the fire was all around him, surrounding him. Ba'u v'amrulo, people come and say to the king, Adoni ha-melech, mipnei ma'at ha-yosheva or beveischa. Master, king, why are you sitting in this house, in this palace, and the fire is all around you? Af kach HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's exactly what the Kadosh Baruch Hu is doing. B'shah she'nichnesu oivim le'echal, ve'tzizu esh beveis ha-mikdash. At the moment when the enemies came and entered into the sanctuary, into the temple, and they set fire to the temple, to the base of Mikdash, Hayah HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yoshev Uvocheh. God was sitting and crying. God was there, not fighting back, not speaking up, but rather crying as the temple is being burned. God is in the temple, crying as it's being burned. Nichnas Asaf Etzlo Ve'amarle. Asaf, I'll say more about Asaf in a moment. Asaf comes to him and says to God, Ribono shel olam, Master of the universe, Ha'ur dolek beveischa, v'ata yoshev, the fire is lit, the fire is going in your house, and you're sitting. Kum, tzem beveischa, get up, get out of your house. You're going to go up in flames with the house, as it were. Shene'amar, harima pamecha l'mashuos, as it says, and this is a very hard verse to translate, lift up the soles of your feet. That part is not so hard. The next two words, we don't really know what it means. What you have here is a JPS translation because of the perpetual fires. Actually, that's not the JPS translation. I changed it. The perpetual something negative, I forget what it is, but all of the outrage of the enemy in the sanctuary. And the pun here is that the word we have here is mashuot, which is actually not clear what it means with a shin, mashuot, but the word masuot would mean torches. And so we're understanding this to mean the fires, right? Lift up your feet, you God, lift up your feet because of the fires that are taking place in the temple. Now, this is a psalm that's introduced as being ascribed to Asaf. Asaf is one of the singers in the first temple period. And so that's why the Midrash here imagines Asaf going and saying to God, not comforting God, not accusing God, but rather saying, God, you're in a house on fire. Get out of the house. So this is the idea now. We've had three sort of steps in our Midrash. We had the first Midrash, which says, God, you're not as good as Yosef. Yosef was done evil to by his brothers, but he did not take vengeance on them. Why are you taking vengeance on us? We had a second Midrash that said, God, you led us on. We did all these great things for you, and we thought we were going to be with you in paradise, and then you attacked us. You let us be destroyed once we came into the land in Jerusalem, into the temple. And God's only response is, well, I was suffering with you. And now we have this third step, which is a kind of building on that, saying, what is God's experience when the temple is destroyed? God is sitting in the fire, paralyzed with God's own sense of terror, with God's own sense of sadness. God is also suffering. It's not a defense. It's just saying that whatever it is that we're suffering, God was also suffering that. Okay. Back in the Midrash, we're on the bottom of page 2 in the English where it says, at that moment, and the Hebrew where it says, Bo'tasha'a. Bo'tasha'a, miskansin kol nevi'im, vochim etzel Yerushalayim lenachama. At that moment, the moment of destruction, all the prophets gathered together, and they went to Jerusalem to comfort her. Amar lahem HaKadosh Baruch Hu. God says to these prophets who are comforting Jerusalem, Lemi atem tzrichim lenachem tchila? Li o Yerushalayim? Who should you comfort first, says God? Me or Jerusalem? And as we'll see, the answer God intends is clearly God, right? This is not God at God's finest. This is not God being generous. This is God saying, you should be comforting me, not Jerusalem. Misha meslo ben, limina menachmim, lola av, God forbid, someone who loses a child. Whom do you comfort? Don't you comfort the parent? You don't comfort the child, you comfort the parent. Misha nisraf beso, limina menachmim, lola ba'alav, someone whose house is set aflame. Whom do you comfort? Is it not the homeowner? You don't comfort the house, you comfort the homeowner. So God here is the parent of Jerusalem. God here is the owner of Jerusalem. So God is the one who is entitled to comfort, says God. Lo kol sheken she'ani tzarich l'tanchumin tchila. Is it not all the more so that I, God, require comfort first? So now we've moved from accusing God to seeing God as needing our comfort, demanding comfort. But I will say, from my point of view, and I think probably from the author of this Midrash's point of view, this is not actually a flattering view of God, right? Because God does not seem to care about us, the people who are actually there in Jerusalem, who are actually being enslaved, being killed, seeing the temple destroyed. Now we're on the top of page 3. Afal pichen lechu faisuha. Nevertheless, God says, go and comfort Jerusalem. So it is true, God says that God actually is the one who's entitled to comfort, not Jerusalem, and I would imagine by extension, the Jewish people. Rather, God is the one who needs comfort, but God says, yes, but nonetheless, go and comfort Jerusalem. Umiskanzen, we're on the top of page 3 now. Umiskanzen kulam beholchen etzla. And they all gather together and they go to Jerusalem. Chevan shehiroa usam omeres lahem lechu lachem. Eini tzarich letanchumin shel beni. They gather, and as soon as she sees them, she says to them, to these prophets who come to comfort her, go away. I don't need tanchumin shel banai. I don't need my children's comforting. That is to say, it's actually a bit of an unclear phrase. I went back and forth about how to translate it. But in the end, what I think this means is, you're my children, you're coming to comfort me. No, I don't need the comforting from my children. Miyad holchim lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. They immediately went before God, right? So these people, they went to Jerusalem to comfort her. God says, why are you comforting her? You should comfort me. But actually go and comfort her anyway. And then she says, no, I don't need your comforting. And her tone is very unclear. One of the things I'll want to hear from you is, what do you think is going on when Jerusalem sends these prophets away and refuses their comforting? But in any event, they now go to God, v'omrim lefanav, and they say before God, Ribono shel olam, master of the universe, eina mekabelas piusin shelanu, she is not accepting our appeasement, our comforting. Amar lahem, God says to them, ein ra'u she'elech ela ani batzmi, v'afaisena, right? It is appropriate that only I go before her and appease her. So God is now going to, God says, you know what? I'm the only one who can comfort, who can appease Jerusalem. And we're about to find out why. Mipnei she'avarti al adin, because I transgressed the law. God says, I'm the only one who can comfort her, seemingly because I'm the one who is at fault. I have done something wrong. I have transgressed, and therefore I need to mifayes her. I need to appease her. This is the same language we use by Yom Kippur, when we say that someone, if I've wronged you, I need to be mifayes you, I need to appease you. And so no, God is the one who's going to come and appease Jerusalem, seemingly because God has done wrong. So here, for the first time, it would seem, we have God not merely accused, but God actually accepting responsibility. The destruction is too much. It's gone too far. And God actually bears some of the responsibility for what God has done to us. Where in the paragraph on page 3 where it says, I wrote in the Torah. Kasavdi b'Torah, I wrote in the Torah. Lo sa'avod bivchor shorecha. Don't work your firstborn ox. Right? So you have a firstborn animal. You're not supposed to work that animal. It's supposed to go to the temple. Uli Yisrael karasi b'ni v'chor Yisrael. And I have called Israel my firstborn child. So you're not supposed to put your firstborn ox into to work them with a yoke. Israel is God's firstborn child. V'amarti lehem, and I said to them, Haviu estavarechem b'ol melech bavel. And I said, you all are going to serve in the yoke of the king of Babylon, of Bavel. What do we have here? God is violating the Torah. You're not supposed to work your firstborn animal. We are God's firstborn child, and God has put us under the yoke. God has transgressed. It continues. Kasavti b'torasi, I wrote in my Torah, Lo sisna esachikra bilvavecha. Don't hate your sibling in your heart. Venis nesiha. And I hated her. Lefichach aniru ilifaisa. Right? You're not supposed to hate your sibling, and yet God has hated us. And apparently, we are God's sibling, and God has hated us, as evidenced by the way that God treats us with the destruction of Jerusalem. Lefichach aniru ilifaisa. Therefore, I am the only one who can actually go and appease Jerusalem. I want to end the Midrash here. I really do. Because this feels like God actually accepting responsibility, that I have gone too far. I'm actually the one who's responsible for your suffering, Israel. I'm the one who's responsible. But we'll see, it does not end here. We're now in the paragraph that begins, immediately the Blessed Holiness. Miyad, halach HaKadosh Baruch Hu etzla ve'amar la. Kase lama. Immediately God goes to her, to Jerusalem, and says, this anger you have, why? It's a strange question, given all that's transpired before this. Amra lefanav, she, and it's not clear to me if we're still out of Jerusalem or if we're back to the Jewish people. I'm not so sure that there's a difference, actually, right? Jerusalem, the Jewish people, whoever it is who's speaking here in this female voice, Amra lefanav says before God, Ribono shel olam, master of the universe, velo echas, sheiglatani levein umos haolam, should I not be angry that you sent me into exile amid the nations of the world, the kilaltani kelalos raos, and you cursed me with horrible curses, v'nasa panai kishule kadera, and my face was blackened like a pot. In ancient texts, this sort of idea of like the face being blackened is a sort of sign of impoverishment, of sort of being so filthy that one can't get clean. Uvacholzos, and nonetheless, even though you've exiled me, you've made me feel like the so filthy, whatever it may be, the cholzos kidashti eshimcha gadol, and nonetheless, I sanctified your name. So why should I be angry? I've done everything, and you have completely destroyed me. Amarla, God now says back to us, the Jewish people, keneged zechus she'asis, kach yesh la'chova. Parallel to all the meritorious things that you've done, all the good deeds that you've done, you also have demerits. You also have culpability. And this is why I got angry on you. I became angry with you. Kasavdi b'zorasi. It's written in my Torah. Kabed es avicha v'es imecha. Honor your father and your mother. V'at kasavt. And you've written. Av v'em hikaluvach. Fathers and mothers have been humiliated within you. So we have a command to treat parents well, and we have violated that. Kasadi usarasi, shofech dam ha'adam, one who sheds the blood of another human being, that is a terrible sin. Va'at, anje rachil hayuvach laman shfoch dam. You have written in the book of Ezekiel, base men in your midst were intent on shedding blood. We're supposed to not be killers, and we have become killers. Kasavdi usarasi, lo sisa, lo tirtzach, lo tinaf, lo tignov. It's written in my Torah, don't take God's name in vain, don't murder, don't commit adultery, don't steal. Va'at ksiv, and about you it is written, alo v'chachesh ratzoach v'ganov v'na'of. False swearing, dishonesty, and murder, and the verse goes on, and theft and adultery are rife in the book of Hosea. So notice the parallelism. God begins by saying, God has transgressed. And God says, here's what I wrote in the Torah, and here's what I actually did, which transgressed that. Here's what I wrote in the Torah. Here's what I did that transgressed that. But now God comes back at us and says, but you know what? You also have transgressed. Here's what's written in my Torah, and here's how you transgressed it. So we have a sort of parallelism between God's failings and our failings. We're now on the top of page 4. Amra lefanav, the Jewish people, Knesset Yisrael says before God, or Jerusalem says before God, really the Jewish people though, you'll see it has to be Jewish people. Ribono shel Olam, master of the universe, kevan shehigletani levein umos haolam, bedin hu shelo shmor Shabbos. Since you have exiled me among the nations of the world, it's logical that I don't need to keep Shabbos anymore. In other words, you've broken the covenant, right? The covenant was, we're going to serve you. We're going to fulfill your Torah. You're going to bring us to the land of Israel. You're going to give us a temple where we can serve you. And you've broken your end of that deal. So now we don't have to keep our end of the deal. We shouldn't have to keep Shabbos. But the kiyamti mitzvosecha. But nonetheless, I have kept your commandments, we say. Amarla, God says to us, kvar biti higia zmanech ligael. The time has come for you to be redeemed. And this seems to be the moment that everything shifts, right? And I said before, I wish I could end the Midrash earlier. Here's another place where I wish I could end the Midrash. This would be a great place to end the Midrash. We say, look, it's not about fairness, because logically, by fairness, we shouldn't have to keep the Torah anymore, and we keep it anyway. And that's the moment that God says, you know what, you're right. It's not about tit for tat. It's not about measuring how many merits and how many demerits you have. It's about this relationship. It's about this love. We're going to come back together. That's where I want the Midrash to end. I think that is the sort of point of this stage of the Midrash. But there's one more stage we have to get through. Amra lefanav. The Jewish people say back to God, Eini misnachemes ad shetar eini ba'osam resha'im shetza'aruni verchafu es shimcha. The Jewish people say before God, I will not be comforted until you show me those wicked people who oppressed me, who put me in pain, and who degraded your name. Miyada Marla, God immediately says back to the Jewish people, to Knesset Yisrael, Biti, ani mevi osam lefanayich, v'nifra behem befanayich. I will bring them before you, and they will pay their fines. They will be punished in front of you, ad she'ochlim es bisaram, until they're eating their own flesh. That's how much I'm going to punish them, God says. Shene'amar, as it says in the book of Isaiah, V'achalti es monayich es bisaram, v'chasis damam yishkarun, v'yadu kol basar ki ani Adonai Moshiach, v'goalech avir Yaakov. I will make your oppressors eat their own flesh. They shall be drunk with their own blood as with wine. And all humankind shall know that I, God, am your Savior, the Mighty One of Jacob, your Redeemer. And that's how this Midrash ends. It ends with God and Israel seeming to come to a rapprochement, coming to an agreement, but Israel demands vengeance on their enemies. Okay, there is a lot in this Midrash. Let me quickly summarize the sections we've seen, ask one or two questions, then open up to you. So the first section, well, first we began with this verse from Song of Songs, that the lover asking, would that we were siblings, not lovers, that we could be unabashed about our love for each other. The first Midrash on that said that God failed because God, Yosef, even though he was treated so poorly by his brothers, did not take vengeance on them. And God can't seem to get over God's own jealousy, God's own vengeance. God is not as good as Joseph. Then we had a second version which said that, which understood that we say to God, sorry, I'm just playing it up for myself, that we remember how good it was with God and how God did miracles for us, and we praise God for those miracles, and we expected that would lead to a life in paradise. But immediately what happens? God actually exiles us and destroys the temple. Then we had God's response, God saying, I'm actually suffering with you. And this extended metaphor, this mashal of God, a sovereign, a human king in a palace on flames, and that's God in the temple. God was in the temple, refusing to leave as the fire was going all around God. And then finally we had this piece about prophets going to comfort Jerusalem, God being upset, you should be comforting me, not Jerusalem, but go comfort Jerusalem anyway. Jerusalem refuses to accept God's comfort, and only God can actually go and comfort Jerusalem. God seems to accept responsibility, says, you know what, I'm the only one who can appease you, who can be mefayes you, because I'm the one who transgressed, but also you transgressed. And then finally we end with the statement that even though logically the covenant is now abolished because God has exiled us, we still keep the mitzvot, and therefore God says, you know what, the time has come for you to be redeemed. And then finally we end with this demand for vengeance on those who caused us suffering. Okay, let me start by asking, I want to start with a technical question that I think will get us into some of the deeper ideas of this Midrash. The technical question is, where do you see the opening verse from Song of Songs? Would that you were like my brother nursing at my mother's breast. Where do you think that comes up in this Midrash? I mentioned one place, the comparison to Joseph. I wish you were like my brother, Joseph, and not like this cruel overlord God.
Mitch said, is this a healthy relationship? Gabriel said, if you'll excuse the blasphemy, there were some lines in Ezekiel that made God seem like an abusive boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
Constanza said, anyone that reads anything on toxic abusive relationships would see that this sounds so abusive. So we've got definitely a theme here.
Right.
Toby said, you shall not hate your brother in your heart. And Gabriel added on, regarding God as abusive, there are many moments leading up to the fall of Jerusalem where he calls the city a whore and variations on that.
Great. So there's definitely a theme here of an abusive parent, an abusive partner. I think it goes back and forth between is an abusive partner, abusive parent. And I think part of what drew me to this Midrash is exactly that, is that I think many of us actually feel that and don't see that generally expressed in our canonical texts. And this is a Midrash that I think does express that, that God, you know, there are there are moments here where I want the Midrash to end, right? Where God sort of takes responsibility. I transgress the law, and that's why I'm the one who has to come and appease you. That's the moment that I want the Midrash to end at. But then it goes on and says, but you also transgressed. And I should say, like, not the concept of abusive relationships, but yes, the concept of Israel and God. Like, I actually think it's important to take both sides into account, right? It's important to acknowledge the ways in which we are culpable for some of what has happened to us, right? A big theme is recognizing that, yeah, we, you know, why was the temple destroyed? Not because God was on a whim, but because we engaged in sinat chinam, in baseless hatred, right? There's culpability there. And that's important. That's a part of the day, is to actually think of our culpability. But what I wanted to focus on in this Midrash, which the Midrash doesn't want me to focus on because it wants to go somewhere else. But what I think we get here that we don't get in other places is some amount of God's culpability. That actually, yes, God has gone too far. And God, even for a moment, right? God backs away. But for a moment, God actually accepts that kind of responsibility. I think that Midrash really highlights that in a way that few, if any, other texts I know do. Okay. In response to the question of the verse about siblinghood, what is important? Don't hate your sibling in your heart. So that's actually a striking thing. We often think about God as a master, God as a parent, God as a sovereign. God as a sibling is not something we have. And here, when God is accusing God's self, one of the things that God accuses God's self of is hating God's sibling in God's heart. And so there's actually a way in which there's a sibling relationship.
I think the connection to Yosef is that Yosef did not take vengeance on his brothers. And actually, if you look at that as a model relationship, clearly the relationship prior to the brothers coming to Egypt is not much of a model relationship. But Yosef is forgiving and doesn't punish his brothers. And Hashem is punishing us. Now, of course, eventually we have a theology that eventually God will, you know, remember us and redeem us. And so eventually he'll forgive us. But it's a lot of punishment until the end, until the very end.
Great. Yeah, I think it's exactly right, Nancy. I mean, that, and I should say that first Midrash, right, the one that accuses God of not being like Yosef, that's actually a Midrash where God doesn't get a chance to respond, right? We say, God, you failed. And the truth is, if I had left it off before the Devar Acher, before the alternate interpretation, we simply would have had an accusation of God, and that's left in the air. And I think that's actually a powerful moment as well. Daniel.
Hi, yes. I want to pick up on a comment in the chat about God admitting error, taking accountability, accepting, you know, being penitent, I guess. And so Gabriel says that the rainbow is a moment of God's taking accountability, but that is accountability to humanity as a whole, because obviously it predates the Abrahamic covenant. So is there an equivalent moment of God taking accountability, accepting, promising not to destroy or take back the Abrahamic covenant as opposed to the Noah covenant?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have this, for example, when God wants to threaten the entire Jewish people and start over with Moshe. And Moshe says, no, like, I won't accept that. I think that's a moment of God saying, okay, I'm actually in it for the long haul with the Jewish people. I think we do have these moments. But in terms of thinking about Tisha B'Av specifically and the destruction of Jerusalem, that's the place where most of our liturgy, I think, is really focused on either just the sadness, which I think is really important to lean into. And like any other year, I mean, just to sort of say the quiet part out loud, any other year, I would have taught something that has us leaning into the sadness, not into the anger at God. Because I think that's really a lot of what Tisha B'Av is meant to be. It's meant to be a day in which we can actually just focus on that. You know, but you also have culpability, as I was saying before, right? That's another important aspect of Tisha B'Av to lean into. But this year, I found myself going into Tisha B'Av feeling like I'm just a lot of anger at God, and not finding a lot of explicit expression of that in our classical texts, in Eicha, in the Midrashim on Eicha. Again, I think there's some implicit moments in Lamentations where we see that kind of anger at God, but it's never really laid out. And again, this Midrash, even though it does bring, you know, it shows God in not a great light, and that makes me uncomfortable, to put it mildly, but I really appreciate that it's, you know, it expresses something that I think many of us have felt. You know, I think people who maybe are more attuned to the suffering of the world felt it before this year, right? Because there's always been a lot of suffering in the world, and there's a lot of reason to be angry at the world. I will admit that I was not that attuned to that before this year. And this was the first time that I really felt my own anger towards God. And this Midrash, I think, really expresses that. And then, yes, God coming along and saying, like, yeah, we're back in it at the end of that Midrash. But it almost feels like sometimes you say something and it's like too stark, and then you just say like a sentence at the end to try to soften it, right? And the end of the Midrash, where God and Israel comes to a sort of agreement, feels like that moment. And really what this Midrash, I think, really, again, what I want to lean into this year is like, you know what? We are not the first to feel that God has done us wrong, and to imagine a version of God that says, you know what, you're actually right. And God can respond by saying, but I'm also suffering with you. God can respond by saying, yeah, you have some culpability in that. But God can also respond by saying that I have some culpability in that as well.
Gabriel asks, isn't the rainbow a moment of God taking accountability? To which Daniel, as he just mentioned, he said this: there isn't an equivalent point after the Jewish covenant. That's a moment of accountability to humanity as a whole, not to us. Dan says, I feel like the concept of an abusive relationship is part of what has alienated many people from Judaism. So much of Hashem as an angry father, not enough of Hashem as a loving mother. And Gabriel said, I feel like even more people are alienated from Christianity for this reason, even though they go for the love stuff a lot more.
Grab it, a pause you there, Ariel, because someone said my favorite word, Christianity and love. So I want to jump in on that for a moment. I hope folks in this room know this, but if just in case, I'll say it out loud. This whole trope that the God of the Hebrew Bible, or as the Christians call it, the Old Testament, the God of Judaism is an angry God, and the God of Christianity is a loving God, that is a trope with a long, long anti-Jewish history. And it is a trope that is very easily disproved. The Bible presents God as angry, and the Bible presents God as loving. And both of those are part of both Torah, both the Bible and of rabbinic literature. If you're interested in this, the best book to read is a book by Solomon Schechter, who, before he was a school, was a scholar of rabbinic literature. He wrote a book called Aspects of Rabbinic Theology. And the whole point of that book is to show all the places in rabbinic literature where God is very much a loving God. So both of those things are there. And I would say, you know, specifically the notion of God as a loving mother, there's a lot of material to sort of leaning into that image as well. But suffice to say, like, that is a trope. And again, in any other year, I probably would have taught those texts. Those are my favorite texts, the ones of God as the loving mother comforting us. But this year, you know, it's interesting. The idea that God here is an abusive partner or abusive parent is totally right. And I think part of why that appeals to me this year, because it allows me to be angrier at God, right? Like, if God were coming along and be like, I'm so sorry, then it would try to mitigate my anger. And right now, what I think I should feel is a lot of anger. And so I think part of the reason why I leaned in this year to a Midrash that does present God in such a negative light, oh yes, and actually Pam Wax points out that Judaism is about love, Rav Scheihel's book. But why I wanted to lean in so much this year to this Midrash, because I think that's also part of religious experience, right? Not just being comforted by a loving God of whatever gender, but also recognize that, yeah, sometimes the world is cruel. And if we believe God has a hand in that, whatever our theology, however we explain that, then there's a role for anger here.
Constanza says, I think regarding the covenant, lots there to wonder if truly it's over, if God breaking his end broke ours. But in reality, even when we walk away theologically, in practice and experiences, it's like we're stuck. people, we have to rally together to survive. And time again, we turn to God no matter what. And Rachel commented that Judaism is the Hotel California of religions. You can check out anytime you like, but it feels like you can never leave.
Let's put this somewhat bluntly. Do you think that this anger that you're describing, like when we talk about God and that God punishing us in terms of like, we did something wrong, and so that's why God punished us. There's a very clear, quote unquote, point to that, in that it motivates us to do tshuva, right? Because there's something that we did wrong, and so we need to fix it. So when we talk about being angry at God, though, what exactly, like, what in there is constructive, or is there anything constructive in that, or does there need to be, or what are your thoughts on that?
Beautiful. Oh my gosh, I love that question so much, Ryan. Thank you for asking that. Yeah, first of all, I love the idea that all of these things have to be constructive. And just like Warren said, you know, the part that's culpability, which again, I don't want to dismiss that part, right? Even though in this midrash, that part comes across as abusive, it is an important part. And I value that. And that's the part that pushes us to do tshuva and to sort of do better. I think anger, there's been a lot. I mean, there's a whole history of philosophy of anger going back to Aristotle and the Stoics and continuing up through, you know, especially in the 20th century, a lot of Black feminist authors getting into the question of, can anger ever be good? And I think anger does a couple different things, one of which is it motivates. So we are more likely to go volunteer for something when we're angry than when we're sad. And so if we have anger, that might motivate us to go and try to change things. Yeah, I think it's sort of, it's a useful rhetorical tool to get other people to see what's going on. But the last thing I'll say about anger as, in terms of its usefulness, is there's also a moral argument for anger that is anger that is not based on usefulness. I'm thinking of a philosopher at Cambridge named Amiya Srinivasan, who's written an article called The Aptness of Anger, in which she argues that anger is kind of akin to beauty. That when you go to a museum and you see beautiful works of art, there's anything that is, at least in a direct way, useful about that, right? You don't make the world better by appreciating the Mona Lisa. But there's something valuable in just sort of naming, this is beautiful. Just naming that is powerful. And Srinivasan argues that anger is not just about something bad happening, it's about an injustice happening, right? I don't get angry that I stubbed my toe. I get angry that I stubbed my toe because my kid left a Lego on the floor, right? Because someone has done something that led to this sad thing, that leads to anger. And that anger, even when it's not useful, Srinivasan argues, is actually a value in itself to sort of maintain our moral clarity. And so I think anger is, you know, now I would say that's really just another way of saying it's useful, right? For Srinivasan, she doesn't want to allow it to be about usefulness, but rather about the morality in and of itself. But either way, however you sort of see that, I think sort of saying our anger against God, especially for those of us who have a theology that God is in some way in control of the world, whether you have a hardcore God is in control of every detail, or God sets things up, or whatever it is, but to or even just express anger at God for God stepping back, right? This idea of tzimtzum, of God pulling back. To express that anger can actually be a powerful descriptor of, yeah, like the world is not what it should be, and we need to be doing the work. So I think that's the piece for me that makes anger either useful, if I want to not worry about Srinivasan's critique of that language, or morally profound.
So these two questions or three-ish questions, I see a little bit as two sides of the same coin. So maybe you can opine. When you were saying that we were kind of saying the quiet part out loud in thinking about our anger right now, one question was October 7th divine punishment? Yeah. And the other side of that is, if God suffers with us, are these catastrophes not his fault? Is he powerless to stop it?
Yeah, so I saw that first one about October 7th being divine retribution when it came up. The chats flash in front of me for a second and then they disappear, which is why it's hard for me to see them. Yeah, I mean, you know, every person in this room has a different theology about God's role in what actually happens in the world. And I will tell you that I don't really know what my theology is. I bounce back and forth between a couple of different ones. Obviously, when things go well, God's totally in control of the world. And when things don't go well, then I am agnostic. Not about God, but about God's role in the world. I will say, sort of, many of the communities I'm a part of, including Yeshivat Hadar, the psalm that we've been saying since October 7th is Psalm 121, where we say, "Hinei lo yanum v'lo yishan shomer Yisrael," the guardian of Israel will not slumber, will not sleep. The sun won't afflict you in the day. The moon won't afflict you at night. And I find that impossible to say. I mean, I've been saying it, but it's been like, I don't think one has to have a theology that God is in control of everything to be angry at God for what has happened. So I am reasonably confident for myself. And again, this is, each of us is going to have a different theology. I'm speaking for myself here. I'm reasonably confident that my theology does not have God responsible for each and every detail. God makes room for free will, and therefore what happened on October 7th was not God's doing. But I do somehow think that there's also a role for God to play in protecting human beings, protecting Jews. And so that's where my anger comes from. And so like that language of was October 7th divine retribution is not language that I would personally use. But that doesn't make me not angry at God for either in a local way or a global way, pulling back from the world, pulling back from that moment and allowing that to happen. And again, this is not to say that there isn't all kinds of culpability for all kinds of people, for all kinds of things that happen in the world. And that's an important message most years. And it's also an important message this year, but it's not the message that I'm feeling right now. The message right now is that I'm leaning into is like, we are suffering and where are you, God? Why aren't you hearing us?
So one question was, is the only way Hashem can comfort Israel by promising vengeance on the enemies? That seems to be what the Midrash is implying.
Yeah, like I said, I really wanted to cut off the Midrash before that moment, just to end with saying, you know, the moment has come for you to be redeemed. And I was like, they don't know the rest of the Midrash. I'll just cut it off and they'll never know the difference. I actually thought about doing that for about 10 minutes. And I was like, I can't do that, right? Like, I know that this Midrash ends this way. Whoever the Midrashist is who composed this wanted that here, and that belongs here. I will say, I actually went to a shir locally here. I'm in Queens for the day, and I went to a shir locally where the rabbi of the shul was sort of reading Eicha through the lens of Kubla Ross's Five Stages of Grief, and it was an important reminder that anger is an essential part of the grieving process. And you know, obviously, it's the second stage, not the fifth stage, and we get it at the end of the Midrash. I am not endorsing what, you know, the vision that I see at the end of this Midrash of like a total bloodbath against our enemies who have afflicted us and oppressed us. That is not my religious view. That's not my politics. But I also, you know, I think I've always known this, but I was glad for the reminder today that like to the extent that people feel anger and need to express that anger even, you know, we have to be careful because when we express that anger, it's not far from expressing that anger to acting out on that anger. And that's where I think things get very dangerous. But the fact that this Midrash expresses this desire for vengeance, I don't think it's good. I think it's understandable, and I think it's probably even necessary. And so I think that's sort of how I now feel about that, and why I'm glad that in the end I didn't cut this out for our learning today.
How can we act out our anger at God? Do we become atheists, pagans? We can't stop being Jews. So what does that look like?
Yeah. So I think on the one hand, I don't think for me, acting out our anger towards God does not take the form of becoming an atheist, because becoming like when I'm angry at someone, I'm angry at you precisely because I believe you exist and you've done something wrong. So I don't really see the connection between anger at God and atheism. I do think it's valuable to express our anger. And I think that's what this Midrash is doing. I think this Midrash is saying like, it's not enough to feel it. You have to actually say it. And then to go back to Oren's question, I think the anger has to be motivated, right? For anger to be moral, I believe, it does have to take us somewhere. And so we have anger about what God has done, whether what God has done to Jews, what God has done to others, to the world, I saw a comment about what God is doing, what's happening in Gaza, right? All of this anger should be a motivator for us to take on some action. And I don't know how we achieve a calming of that relationship with God. I think it makes sense that, you know, I don't know how long it takes anger to get worked through. I will say also, just speaking very autobiographically, you know, I'm someone who for a long, long time struggled with feeling God's presence. Like I was, you know, I was okay with belief. I sort of had rational belief in God, but I didn't really, it wasn't visceral, right? It was like, oh yeah, like, of course God exists. Here are my reasons, blah, blah, blah. And really sort of feeling anger towards God in the last year has been the first time I really felt a sort of visceral, like God is there, but not the way that I want God to be, but actually I'm furious with God. And so I'm personally just like working it through. You know, I think, you know, if we go back to this Midrash, what does Midrash tell us about working that sense through? I think Midrash says that actually what brings that relationship from a place of anger to a place of coming together is saying, we're going to stay in this relationship, right? Even though we've each, according to this Midrash, violated this covenant, we stay in it, right? We continue keeping these commandments, even though God has afflicted us. And that's actually the thing that can bring us together.
I wanted to say that it feels like a lot of wasted energy to be mad at God. Like we sort of have this like concentration or being angry at Hashem for something. And it just seems like doing that is like not taking action. It's like, okay, we're wasting so much time being mad at God. There are actual people who are doing things that are not okay.
Yeah, I totally hear that. I'll say, I never made a conscious choice to be angry at God after October 7th. Mm-hmm. Like, I wasn't like, oh, I'm entitled to feel angry. I just felt angry. And I think that's true for a lot of people. And if folks in this room, if there are, and I'm confident, 100% confident, that there are other folks in this Zoom room who also felt that way. And I'm confident there are folks who felt that way before October 7th because the world was broken and suffering before October 7th. And if there are other folks who are like, I see that the world is suffering, I see that we are suffering, and I don't feel anger, I feel motivated to act without anger, I think that's great. Like it is not my goal in reading this Midrash to be like, everyone should be angry. My goal in reading this Midrash is to say, if you're feeling angry, you're not alone. You're not the first to feel angry at God. And then this conversation has led us to a place, which is not where I was thinking about going with it, but I'm really glad it's taken us here. That's not enough, right? Eventually our anger has to take us to a place of actually doing something to actually mitigate the suffering and pain in the world. You know, that I think is an essential piece of this. And maybe in some ways that's what B'nai Israel is saying to God when Knesset Israel is saying to God when we say, we continue to keep Shabbos, right? Now Shabbos is not an interpersonal commandment, it's a ritual commandment. So you can either sort of broaden that or think about the ways in which Shabbos is actually a way about trying to figure out how to make a world that actually is the way it should be. But I think this conversation has shown that, yeah, the anger is not enough. And if you're not feeling that anger, I'm actually really impressed with that. Like, I think that's fantastic. I think you're right, Miriam, that there's a way in which it is, I wouldn't say a waste, but it takes a lot of energy to be angry. What I'm saying is that I think that anger can be channeled to go somewhere redemptive, such that, God willing, next year on Tisha B'Av, we'll be living in a world in which we aren't seeing massive bloodshed. We aren't dealing with hostages still in captivity. We are living in a redeemed world. And Tisha B'Av is actually a holiday and not a day of destruction.